Today's program is brought to you by the Museum of Food and Drink, sparking curiosity about food with exhibits you can eat. For more information, visit mofad.org.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network, broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
Good afternoon and welcome to episode 20 of Why Food. I'm your host, Patrick McAndrew. Each week I'm joined by a new guest who has made the transition from a previous career into the food industry. And the show is here to share inspiring stories of people who have restarted their careers and followed their passions into the world of food and wine. This week, Donald Skeehan joins me on the show. I'm very proud because Donald is a fellow Irishman who has published 7 cookbooks and has been on numerous cooking shows across 4 different countries. His newest cookbook to be released in the States is Fresh, which is full of nourishing and energizing recipes for the home cook. I've been delighted to have tested and tried some of them, and I'm really very proud to have him on the show here because he's a great guy and he's flying the flag very high for Irish food. Thanks very much for joining me on the show today, Donald.
Thanks very much, Patrick. Good to hear from you.
Yeah, you too, man. How's everything going on the West Coast?
Very good, very good. It's a sunny day in California and all is well.
Last time I met you, it was grey and gloomy on St. Patrick's Day in New York, so the tide has turned now.
Definitely. Yeah, no, I do love New York, and I have to say, I always love my trips out there. Food-wise, it is an incredible place to be, but yes, the sunshine does have those extra benefits, I have to say.
It does. It certainly brings a smile to the face. How long have you been living out in California?
So I've been out here for the last 3 months. We moved in January, but we spent a lot of last year kind of trying to figure out how to relocate and where to relocate. And we are absolutely loving it and really adapting to kind of our new little neighborhood. They say when you kind of move to Los Angeles, it's all about finding your little LA bubble. And we've definitely found it out on the east side. And from a food perspective, we fell on our feet, basically.
Yeah, I've been following you on Instagram and you've been cracking through so many places. The food looks delicious out there.
I know.
What led to you actually moving out to the States? Because you were based in London for a while, right?
I've actually always worked in London, but I've never lived there. Over and back. I mean, anyone who lives in Dublin knows that, you know, if you've worked in London, it's practically an hour's commute on a flight. So sometimes it felt like I was living there, but it definitely I've always been based out of Dublin. So it's been quite a big jump from Dublin to LA, but you know, from that point of view, trying to figure out why we were coming here came down to, we were actually shooting a documentary about the world of YouTube. I started a YouTube channel maybe 3 years ago, and after being inspired by Jamie Oliver, who had me on his channel and was kind of talking about the growth of, you know, online food media. And so from there, we were shooting a documentary just about the growth of YouTube as a platform and the people, you know, the different aspects of culture that are play a part of YouTube's makeup. And I went to this festival called VidCon, which takes place every year in Anaheim. And it's this crazy place where, you know, all these super fans come and they're screaming girls. It's kind of like the Beatles, but for a complete new generation. And we just went there and just realized that the hub of, you know, these YouTube creators was in Los Angeles. And, you know, I've even been here for like the last 3 months, and you know, we've collaborated with other food YouTubers, and it's been a great opportunity to kind of start meeting new people in a much kind of wider net, I guess. But yeah, that was kind of the catalyst. And I also have a contract with Food Network over here as well. So we've just shot a pilot that actually aired on last week.
Yeah. So, Gone in America. Yeah, right.
Gone American. Yeah. So that just aired. And I've been on a show called Star Kids that I hosted with Tia Mori over here. So it's basically, you know, it's been a
whirlwind of opportunities for you.
Exactly. New opportunities. And, you know, I've been doing what I've been doing in Ireland for the last seven or eight years. And from my perspective, you know, we've done so much over there, and it was the time to kind of try new avenues, and really excited just about the whole process. And it's been fun so far, so let's keep it going.
Yeah, absolutely. And you're a guy who brings a lot of fun to what you do. So just to go back to Dublin and back to Ireland and your upbringing, because a lot of people in the States, they would know you through I'm sure a lot of people would know you through YouTube because you have over 500,000 subscribers, or through Instagram, you have over 100,000 followers on there. But I suppose what a lot of people wouldn't know is necessarily your background growing up in Dublin, in Ireland, and how your ties were there with food from a very early age with your parents and with their business.
Yeah, so I mean, I grew up in a food family, essentially, and it kind of goes back 60 years. My granddad used to have a shop on Dorset Street, which used to sell fruit and vegetables. He also used to bottle his own Guinness, and I always remember my
bottle
dad,
his own Guinness.
I don't know if it was, but yeah, I'm pretty sure it was. Or he used to put the stickers on that actually had the skiing name on the Guinness labels. So we have a whole load of these labels that have the skiing name on the Guinness bottles. But it was, yeah, I mean, so I grew up with that, and my dad would have grown up with it, and he certainly took, you know, that mantle of food, and he started a food fruit and vegetable business, and grew up from that into wholesale fruit and vegetables to the restaurants in Dublin, and then grew it on to basically being a food supplier for most of the supermarkets in Ireland. So it's grown so bigger than, you know, that little shop on Dorset Street in Dublin to this great big thing that my mom and him have basically done all by themselves. And you know, having grown up in that sort of environment where, you know, you have people who are working all the time, and, you know, it's a family business, you really have an understanding and an appreciation for hard work. And I think if I hadn't had that, I certainly wouldn't be doing what I do today.
And with that as well, growing up in Ireland in the 80s and 90s, where food was relatively basic, you had a whole range of fresh produce in your house that probably a lot of people wouldn't have had available to them, or wouldn't have been eager to play with.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. And I think, you know, that really gave me an appreciation for food at a very early age. You know, we were trying to, you know, the new product my dad would have brought in, or the new bit of produce he'd come home with in a crate. And I was telling you before about a story where my granddad used to have the shop on Dorset Street, and my dad used to supply the catering college, which was the local, you know, the place where people, they would train up the chefs. So they would order these sorts of odd bits of produce, and certainly odd for the 1980s or 1970s Ireland, which was a bit lacking on the food front. But my dad always tells the story of the fact that he had he'd bought in a big pallet of aubergines and could only get rid of half of them to the catering college, and left the rest in the shop with a big sign saying aubergines £5.90, whatever it was. And my granddad came in and said, "What the hell are you doing with all those aborigines? You'll never sell them." So you can just kind of tell the appreciation for produce in Ireland back then was not at the height it is now.
It was scant. I can tell you that much. It was scant. Yeah, it's changed.
I don't know if that plays to my granddad's lack of literacy or what, but either way, there definitely wasn't aubergines in Ireland.
Well, you and I can proudly tell other people from other countries that times have changed, and people now know what they're looking at when they go in and look at different types of fruit and veg.
Absolutely. I mean, we are in Ireland right now, we are at the height of, you know, our food knowledge and our passion for food. And it's a really exciting time in Ireland, you know, in terms of the sorts of cafes you can go to and get really great, dishes for very, very little money. But you have passionate people who are, you know, who have traveled around the world, who have taken inspiration and have come back and put their Irish kind of twist on it. And I think that, for me, is what's so exciting, because, you know, you can have local and you can have seasonal, but, you know, I think if you want to have a broad view on food, you do have to travel and you do have to experience new things. And the world we now live in is open to that side of things. And I think that's quite exciting, and it's something that, you know, we should embrace rather than being kind of afraid of.
Yeah, absolutely. And actually, since I've last seen you, I came to realize that you might have known this, that the best young chef in the world, done by the same competition within the world's 50 best restaurants, was an Irish guy in 2015, Mike Moriarty.
I've come across him, actually. Yeah.
So I actually only found that out in the past 3 weeks, and I was very impressed to know that. So it's good to see that that other people are getting recognition from within the Irish food scene.
Absolutely. So, you know, I think from a food point of view, like what chefs are doing in Ireland is just, it really is up there with the best in the world. And that's a true testament to that.
Yeah. And in maybe 2-3 months, I'm hoping to do a live podcast based on the Irish Food Revolution. So I'll be notifying listeners about that when that comes around. So I'm very excited about doing that soon. So let's go back to the wonderful, pretty unique aspect or a few years in your life. So you grew up with a food centric family. You grew up ingratiated in food, loving food. But then you stepped away from that for a while because you went into the music business. You became a pop star for a short while.
Yeah, it was for my mom, it was the equivalent of going off and joining the circus, essentially. But yeah, I mean, it's really funny, you know, I've been working in the world of food for a long time now, and it's still the thing that kind of gets brought up in interviews. And it is, I mean, it's such a novelty that, you know, for this very brief amount of time, you know, when I was about 20, I had this completely different career, and I was singing, we were supporting the Pussycat Dolls, and we were doing tours, and, you know, we were shooting music videos in Spain, and we were doing all sorts of crazy things, and recording in Sweden, and it was just a whole different world to what I do now. And we had a little bit of success in Ireland. We had two Irish number one singles, and I always, you know, I always look back at that, like thinking, you know, when I'm 60 or 70 or, you know, 80, I'm going to look back at that going, that was just one of the best times of my life, and I loved doing it. But, you know, in true pop band terms, these things have a lifespan, and ours was fairly short. I think we were in the band all in all probably about a year and a half.
But you guys managed to get two Irish number ones during that time, which is pretty good going.
Yeah, well, I mean, I should point out that two Irish number ones are probably the equivalent of about 10,000 records. So it's not like, you know, you're not going to retire on it, but it's certainly an achievement at home.
But did it kind of impact you as you went later in life, you know, to be such a sensation on YouTube where you're going to be in front of the camera with food? Because it appears very easy, you know, what you do. You're there and you're very calm and you're discussing the products and you're having a laugh. But it's very difficult to do all that multitasking and to be calm and composed in front of the camera. During that time working in music, did that kind of give you a training of how to act and how to remain composed and kind of keep everything running through in your mind while you're performing?
Well, firstly, thank you very much for that compliment, but I would probably compare it more to a duck in a water who looks very calm and serene on the top and underneath they're paddling like the Jesus.
So that's the beauty of the tabletop up to your hips, is it? That's your legs flailing underneath the tabletop.
Exactly. That's why I have to stand behind counters. But yeah, no, I absolutely do think, you know, played a part in it, and certainly, you know, my role in the band, because I wasn't the best singer, I would say, is, you know, the person who would always have spoken in interviews and, you know, talked on camera. And so it certainly gave me a feel for what was expected in the world that I now work in, you know, from the TV side of things. And yeah, I mean, the confidence you get from doing those sorts of things, and, you know, people always ask me, you know, if you're doing TV work or, you know, anything like that, do you get nervous? And once you go out on a stage in front of 16,000 people and you you have to perform, that nervousness just dissipates really, really quickly. And you know, anything I do now, I still get those butterflies, but I don't get like the, you know, the terrifying nerve that would prevent you to do something. And I always have that kind of, and I think, you know, that goes not only from the music side of things, but also from, you know, the upbringing I would have had with my mom and dad about, you know, hard work, is that when it comes down to crunch time, you just have to put your head down and get work hard and get the job done. And I think that's always been my approach, and, you know, it definitely did help along the way, but I think it's certainly something that's part of my upbringing as well.
Yeah, and, you know, you talk about hard work, and you're 30 years of age and you've produced 7 cookbooks. That's pretty amazing. It's a remarkable achievement. But what's very interesting is that you kind of created your own path at that age in a country like Ireland, where food blogging in 2007 wasn't necessarily an industry or a business or a profession. You managed to latch onto it and you had great writing, but you mentioned before that one of the things that kind of set you apart was the fact that you had photographs with your food blog, which many others didn't.
Yeah, I mean, when I started, you know, I obviously had the interest in food growing up, but I think when I started a food blog, you know, it was my first opportunity to kind of categorize and kind of actually write proper recipes. And I'll be honest with you, like, at the time, I had no idea what I was doing. I was doing it because I loved it, and I was doing it because I was looking at other food blogs at the time. You know, the early stages, there was probably Matt Bites and Pioneer Woman and Smitten Kitchen. Those were the big food blogs that I would have been sitting in an office reading every day, thinking I'd love to do that. And I love the instantaneous nature of blogging that kind of gave you that instant reaction with an audience. And from that point of view, that was what kind of captivated me. But also from the creative side of coming up with a new recipe and photographing it and, you know, making it, you know, look as beautiful as you know it tastes was always the challenge. But at the time in Ireland, which was probably about 2006, 2007, there was absolutely, I think there was, you know, a handful of blogs, probably about six or seven that were active and that were putting out content. And very few of them actually had photography attached to them. And, you know, for me, food has always been such a visual art form that to not have the photographs match the recipes was, you know, it wasn't the way I was going to do it. I wanted to make sure that they were there full frontal and, and
absolutely,
you got a recipe and a good, you know, a good recipe and a good photograph as well. And that kind of, that spurred me into another career that I, you know, I never thought would be part of what I do. But food photography has literally given me probably all the opportunities I've had, because if I didn't have food photography, I wouldn't be able to showcase what I can do. And I wouldn't be able to, you know, even to the point of like writing an article, you know, even now I still write, I write for the Irish Times, and, you know, I photograph all my recipes, and, you know, that in itself is a unique thing. I mean, there's very few people doing that, and I take great pride in it. You know, it's something I'm passionate about. So, so it's a big part of what I do, but I never knew it would go down that angle.
Just to touch on that, like, what are some of the key components of food photography? Because we live in a world now where we have our phones and food is photographed before it's eaten and it's shared amongst friends, and everyone wants to have that wonderful picture that looks fantastic. Now, you have great pictures, but some of them have a very common through line, where there will be kind of a tablecloth there or a checkered napkin or kind of a rustic wooden almost door looking, or it's a table, and, you know, those kind of the contrast of like colors against the plate of the food. What are some of the like key things that you look for when you're going to be taking when you're doing food photography?
Well, there's a lot that goes into it. I mean, my aunt is a food stylist, and she probably would have given me the sort of inspiration and the catalyst to actually realize that I could do it myself. And from that point of view, you know, there's so much that goes into it, and people forget that. And going back to those kind of early stages of food photography, where, you know, you'd have food stylists varnishing turkeys for the amazing Christmas spread, or, you know, just to make it look gorgeous, that has kind of moved, that things have moved away from that slightly now. And the aim is to really capture food at its best when it comes out of the oven, or it looks its finest, rather than painting it with oils and spritzing with water and stuff. You really just want to do those kind of subtle things that make all the difference to making it look good. But things like props, you know, I try and keep it as simple as possible. And certainly I look back at my earlier photos where you'd have about 15 pots in the background of flowers and everything. And actually you cringe to some extent, but then at the same time, you're on a learning process.
Absolutely, yeah.
You're on a journey. So, you know, I look back at it and go, that's how I used to photograph, and this is how I do it now. And I think you're constantly evolving, and I'm sure that'll change again in 10 years. But, you know, really composing your shot is the biggest aspect of food. You know, it's still life in some ways, you know, and you're trying to capture it so that it's not just the life, that it feels alive. It feels like you could, you know, reach into the screen and grab it. And, you know, I think with food photography, it is one of the hardest forms. And, you know, you'll see a lot of photographers who, you know, are fashion photographers who try and do a food photograph, and it's a completely different thing, you know, and they'll struggle to get a good photograph of food. So it's something that I've just kind of, I've fallen into in some respects, but, you know, as time goes on, like, I love that aspect of it. I love the creative side of it. And, you know, one of my favorite things is when we're shooting a cookbook, where I can literally put down 2 weeks and solely focus on food photography. And it feels like I'm less of a jack of all trades and I get to be a master of one for 2 weeks.
Right.
which is great. But I think what goes into a good food photograph is, you know, number one, really great food. Number two, simple composure and props. And really, you know, a good camera that will take a good photo. I mean, you can get great shots on your iPhone, and people kind of forget that. I mean, there was a fantastic issue. I think it was Bon Appetit magazine shot their entire issue with an iPhone, probably 2 years ago or something. But it was just a showcase of, you know, if your food looks good and if your propping is simple and if you're true to what the food actually is and you're not messing around with it too much, you can really get a great food photograph. And as many people will attest, considering, you know, everyone now has to take a photo of the food before they eat it, you know, you can get great images of food in the least likely of situations.
Yeah, just make sure the settings are nice and the lighting is good. But just to go back to what I was mentioning earlier, because just to give a quick explanation of how it came to be, you had a blog while you were on tour with the band. Then was it the TV deal or the book deal came first from the blog?
So I had been food blogging for about 6 or 7 months, and so rather out of the blue, I got contacted by a small Irish publishing house called Mercia Press, and they were really interested in the idea. They had actually just done their first cookbook with a food blogger, who also has one of the best ice cream shops in Ireland, the Murphy Brothers. And they were blogging at the time, and they were kind of using it as a means to promote their ice cream shop. And so this small Irish publisher, they created an ice cream book with the guys. And so off the back of that, they liked the idea of getting some young upstart to do a book. And, you know, I look back at it and I go, I was probably the least qualified for the job. I was probably, you know, the least experienced for taking on a project like that. But, you know, if I had not taken that opportunity, and if I'd said no because I was a little bit worried about, you know, not getting, you know, not being, not having all those qualifications that you should have when you're writing a cookbook, I would never be where I am today. And I really think, you know, there's a lesson in that. You know, there's a nervousness about, you know, the world of food, and there's a nervousness about those aspects. And, you know, I think in some ways, yes, absolutely, you know, be sure of who you are. But when it comes down to it, if you have an opportunity, you have to take it. And, you know, you will learn along the way. But from that aspect, you know, from my point of view, the book went from it won the Best Irish Published Book Award that year, and then followed on from that from getting picked up on TV. So it really kind of spurred on a career that I never knew was available, and it just has continued to grow, and I'm very thankful every day about it.
And what was the focus of that cookbook when you wrote that one?
So it was called Good Mood Food, and it was all about, you know, and actually the reason I wrote it was named after the blog I was writing at the time, and it was really about how I was cooking, because for the first time I was, you know, I'd moved in with my girlfriend, now wife, Sophie, and we just moved into a new apartment, and for me it was about food that was really nutritious, and it was food that was feeding not only our lifestyle, but also, you know, the good aspects of what we needed in terms of nutrition. And so I was really interested in that side of things. And I think, you know, when the blog started, that was why people were kind of hooked into it. You know, they liked that idea of real cooking, but with kind of a balanced approach to it. And that's something that certainly continues throughout the sort of food that I cook nowadays. And it's something that I always kind of come back to. My dad annoyingly always says that's his favorite book. When I look back at it, I go, oh my God, like the pictures are terrible and the recipes aren't like written the way they should be. And, you know, but it's funny, I get a lot of people saying that, you know, that they just love the kind of, I suppose there's a rawness to it, and there's a, you know, there's a freshness to it, because it's, you know, it doesn't follow the constraints of what other people have done before, and it doesn't follow the constraints that, you know, you'd expect from a book. And there is a lovely freshness to it when I do look back at it and don't cringe about it.
Well, I think that goes hand in hand with your career to date, because there has been an element of freshness with everything that you've done, and you've continued to roll in with, like I said, cooking shows in 4 different countries, and you've produced 7 books, and you've kind of created this career path that wasn't necessarily there back in 2007 for yourself, because sure, it was there for chefs that wanted to take steps outside of the kitchen and write cookbooks and appear on TV shows, but there was nothing necessarily for, there is now for bloggers, but back then there wasn't for people who were just cooking really good food at home. And had a certain opinion on, you know, how food should be cooked and keeping it simple. And somehow you, like, that's one thing I want to know. How did that happen? Was it a case that, I know you've mentioned that you had a vision and a focus and that everything just kind of fell into place during the way. Was that how it happened? Or were you looking to the next step all the time and seeing how you could do something different and something innovative each time you did a new cookbook or a new TV show?
Well, I think you've hit the nail on the head in terms of, you know, figuring out what your kind of unique take on it is. And, you know, I said in my first TV show, which most likely I was given loads of stick about, but I'm not a chef. I'm a home cook, and I create recipes for the food that I cook at home. I don't have a large pantry filled of, you know, rare breed pigs, and I don't have, you know, pheasants coming in on a daily basis. This is real cooking, and this is why, you know, I still to this day look at why, you know, people come to me for recipes. And I do put it down to the fact that, you know, there's recipes with five ingredients, or there's recipes using stuff you're guaranteed to have in your store cupboard. Sometimes I feel like I sound like a broken record about it, but, you know, those are the reasons why people do come back to my recipes, and they have that simple approach. And, you know, I've tried to kind of move things along the way, but, you know, I even now, it's funny, you know, we did a whole TV series called Donald's Irish Feast, and we did kind of really, really intricate kind of dishes and slightly kind of next level stuff. And, you know, from that perspective, you know, people expect, you know, more simple dishes from me. And I think in some ways it's about doing that, but also kind of trying to push people along and trying to include them in the cooking world. And I think you have to do that in a subtle way and in a gentle way. But I do think, you know, the approach from the start has always been the same, and that is simple recipes done easily and really with great results at the end. And I think that's why people do come back.
And with simple recipes, there's no specific genre of food, is there? There's no central ethnicity with the food that runs through. Is it just kind of, because, you know, you have recipes that range from all over the world. So where do you gather the inspiration from to do these recipes?
Well, it's funny, you know, it's something I might have got a bit of stick about, you know, and I certainly remember one critic giving out about the fact that, you know, I had recipes from all over the world. But, you know, I look at that, and, you know, I look at how I eat, and I look at, you know, cooking for me has always been, you know, as much as I'm talking about, you know, trying to get people in and getting them cooking and with simple recipes, for me, you know, cooking and my approach to food has always been a somewhat selfish one. You know, I eat the food I love to eat, and, you know, a big part of my life is travel, and, you know, I love to travel. It's one of my biggest sources of inspiration. I've been to Thailand, I've been to Vietnam, I've been to Africa, I love to travel, and really from that perspective, you know, I am a kitchen, or I'm a food magpie essentially, and I love, you know, I travel with a notebook everywhere I go, and if I see something I like, the idea, I like a method, or, you know, I try a new food or an ingredient, that's where, you know, I'm passionate about it, and that's where I get excited about doing that. So I never apologize for, you know, taking inspiration from somewhere like Thailand, even though I'm Irish through and through. But, you know, I think going back to what we talked about, you know, about the food scene, even in Ireland, where it's, you know, we have, you know, there's a limit to what we can grow and what we can forage and what, you know, but at the same time, we have to be realistic, and the access we have to these world ingredients are now more widely available than ever before. And so, you know, absolutely know who you are and stay true to your food roots. But at the same time, there's this fantastic world of food out there that if you're not exploring and if you're not, you know, trying, you're missing out. And so I never apologize for, you know, the idea of kind of looking elsewhere for inspiration. And, you know, when it comes to quick cooking and simple dishes, you know, there's so much new ideas out, so many new ideas out there. And I think that's where, you know, a lot of my inspiration comes from, for sure.
Yeah, and it provides for a very, very colourful cookbook, and it keeps things fresh, as is the name of your new cookbook. But before we get to that and we discuss your move to the States and working on TV, we're just going to go to a quick break.
Hi, I'm Dave Arnold, the host of Cooking Issues on the Heritage Radio Network. We all know and love Chinese takeout dishes like General Tso's chicken and egg rolls, but here's the thing. Even though we call it Chinese food, it's not like the food you'd find in China. What's the story behind this cuisine, and how did it become so popular that you can find a Chinese-American restaurant in nearly every town in the country? The answers may surprise you. Visit the Museum of Food and Drink in Brooklyn and see our newest exhibition, Chow, Making the Chinese-American Restaurant. Chow engages visitors with compelling accounts of how Chinese immigrants overcame racism and created Chinese-American cuisine. Discover the science behind the flavors of your favorite takeout dishes, feast on rotating tastings developed by the country's most talented Chinese-American chefs, and try your hand at writing your own fortune, which will be baked into actual cookies by a 1,500-pound fortune cookie machine. What better way to learn, connect, and eat? You can visit Chow at the Museum of Food and Drink on Fridays through Sundays from noon to 6. Tickets and more information can be found at mofad.org.
Welcome back to Why Food. I'm here with Donald Skehan, and we have just been discussing his career up until his cookbooks and everything that he curates and his online presence. Now we're going to move on to your move to the States. Something that I'm just kind of curious about is what you've noticed between the difference in the food culture from coming in Ireland and the UK to being in the States, because it's something that I noticed. It opened up my eyes moving out here, because people were... It was... It's different because the culture of food is very different to Europe, because there's no real roots in terms of, maybe if you go down south, there is more so. But certainly being in a metropolises like New York and LA, it's very current and it's very, very much so about trends and the new restaurants and the new cook. Have you found that there's a major difference in the food culture on the West Coast and during your time in New York compared to being in Ireland and the UK?
It's an interesting one, you know, because obviously, like, I think you're right, like in New York and Los Angeles, there is this kind of, there's almost like a flurry and a frenzy towards where the new restaurants are and the new trends and that side of things. And I think there's definitely, we definitely have that in Ireland as well. But I think, you know, what's the stark differences between Irish food and what happens in America is that you have kind of different tiers of food here, you know, and I would say that you have, like, obviously you have this chef style food, and that's happening in all the restaurants. But then you also have, you know, this unbelievably and kind of, you know, you can't deny it, you know, there's this huge fast food culture here, you know, and, you know, this sort of slightly unhealthy aspect of food that takes place in America. And then on the other flip side of that, certainly when you come to California, you are undoubtedly aware of, you know, the acai bowls and the smoothies and the juice brigade and the chia seeds. And, you know, so you have these kind of really sort of, you know, they're kind of opposing forces in food all taking place within this one kind of this one culture. And, you know, it's quite inspiring because you kind of feel a little bit like a bit schizophrenic when it comes
yeah,
to food.
I totally agree with you.
You know, because on one day I want a big dirty burger, and then on the next I'm having a green juice, and then on the other, you know, the other day I'm eating in a really great restaurant. And so you're constantly torn by the food here. And I think in some ways that's why it's exciting. That's why, you know, every day is different. I mean, I was saying, we were driving home the other evening, myself and my wife, and, you know, I was just going, this is just brilliant. Like, in one weekend I've eaten Korean food, I've eaten, you know, some of the best local seasonal produce from a farmer's market down the road, and then on the morning of that same morning I went into this like Thai restaurant that we were the only English-speaking customers in, and we were eating, you know, rice porridge and poached egg. And it was just like, that's what I love about this city, is that there is just so much on offer, and there's so many, you know, so many different things happening. And so from a food culture point of view, I would say that is the starkest, you know, difference to back home, is that it just feels like there's a few extra layers to the food that takes place here.
Yeah, the amount of people within the country and within cities like LA and New York certainly adds to it, because they bring over so much culture from their own heritage with them, and you have great access to so much food. Even in Flushing in Queens, you can go out there and it's like, I've heard this figure, I don't know if it's true, but I've been told that it's the most densely populated area of Chinese people outside of China. And you certainly feel that way when you get out there, because the Chinese food is incredible, and there's a lot of people who don't speak English out there. So you feel like you're totally, you're in the real scenario, you know, instead of having sesame chicken or orange chicken, you're actually having some of the real stuff.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, that's what kind of, you know, and even when you come here, then you have, you know, people who've taken their culture, or who have grown up with that culture in America and taken inspiration. I mean, Roy Choi is a perfect example of, you know, like the success of these Kogi dog food trucks. You know, you have Korean kimchi hot dogs, you know,
yeah,
the complete, you know, epitome of, you know, fusion food, but done really well. And, you know, without that kind of cringe-worthy title that I've just given it. But, you know, it is that sort of element that people, you know, have created this other food culture that just, you know, comes out of the fact that there are so many cultures at play here.
And with the difference that of the different outlook that people have on food in the States compared to Ireland and the UK, have you found a difference in hosting shows? Is there a difference in the media side of it as well?
Absolutely. I now say cilantro and eggplant and give temperatures in Fahrenheit. But yeah, and it's so funny because I do these things, and like, I know that people at home are already cringing, and like that I'll get so much stick when I get at home. But honestly, it's like speaking another language, like, because if you don't say those things,
yeah, people just don't have a clue.
They're looking at you like you have five heads. Like I told a lady, I was going to a supermarket shop the other day, and I told the lady I just had to run out and put my shopping in the boot. And she didn't have a clue of what I was talking about. Because basically I meant my, and then I changed it to I'm putting my groceries in my trunk. And she went, oh yeah, no problem. And I was like, could you not have, like, even just jump, try and see what I was, And actually, I do laugh at this because I think from an Irish point of view, we are natural communicators and we will always try and make someone, you know, even if we hear a foreign accent, we will always go out of our way to try. Like, you will notice one thing that Irish people do is, like, finish other people's sentences.
Yeah.
So we always try and kind of, like, make sure that the other person feels comfortable and that we are doing our darndest to understand you. But that does not happen in America.
No,
for sure.
We have to come to their level. And it's great. It's great. But I find myself that even though I will know the right thing to say, I will still say the wrong thing and then have someone say what? And then I will say the right thing because I feel like I need to hold on to those important words that kind of make me or have my Irish heritage in them. Because the day that I forget what coriander is or aubergine and then I start calling it eggplant and cilantro, that's a bad day. I think I need to hold on to those important words that mean a lot to me.
You're dead right. You're dead right. We can discuss this further over a bowl of arugula.
Rocket. So anyway, Donal, let's go to the cookbook because Fresh is a cookbook that I really enjoyed cooking with and reading because, as you have done with your YouTube channel and previous cookbooks, it's very simple and it certainly ties into the modern day person. You acknowledge that people are taking stuff on the go. You even have a pantry section of things that you can pre-make that you can keep in there for a week or 2 weeks and then incorporate into various dishes as they're needed. What was your inspiration for creating Fresh when you were writing it?
Fresh is an interesting one because I think of all the cookbooks I've written, this has been possibly the most personal one, in that, I come back to this kind of selfish approach to writing cookbooks. But, you know, I look at the cookbooks as like as my playbook for a year or 2 years or 3 years or 4 years of recipes that I'm going to touch back base with and, you know, really cook from and use as part of my daily life. And Fresh came at a time where we'd had all the success. We'd had all the TV shows. We'd had the book tours, we'd been traveling around, you know, doing TV series in Thailand to Italy. And from it had got to a point where I was no longer appreciating the food. You know, I was going from one job to the next and not getting an opportunity to stop. And, you know, it sounds dramatic, but, you know, I remember being in Vietnam and actually just collapsing from exhaustion and being ill and ending up in this hospital in Vietnam and going, I do not want to be in here and I definitely don't want to get myself back in a situation like this. And it just came from exhaustion and, you know, and not eating the food that we really do need to be eating on a regular basis. And like, I'm only 30, but at the same time, you know, I my diet has changed and, you know, I looked at that the food that I once ate when I was in my 20s is not the food that I can, you know, I can sustain, you know, energy on that I do now. And Fresh really was a kind of a step back and a way to kind of go, hang on a second, I need to find balance in what I'm doing and an appreciation for the food that I'm eating and the food I'm cooking. And so Fresh really was a playbook for a healthier, more balanced approach to food. And, you know, I think the reason it's resonated with a lot of people is because most people do go through that point of, you know, of kind of reaching their 30s and going, okay, hang on a second, I can't eat the food I used to eat. You know, I can't eat a pulled pork burger and only exist on that for the day and then go out drinking or whatever. This is much more, you know, this is a really, I suppose it's a retake on how I eat. And I certainly think it was why it resonated with people. But, you know, you look at the sorts of recipes that are in there, and yes, I'm including chia seeds, and yes, there is a cauliflower pizza base, and yes, there's
which
a
is
green
delicious.
Smoothie. But all these things, you know, are how I kind of I approach things. You know, it is about a balance, and you know, I am a food lover. I love every aspect of food. If it's a big dirty barbecue, or if it's, you know, a really great green salad just simply dressed with a vinaigrette, you know, I love food, and that side of it, you know, I knew if I was going to eat healthily and I was going to have that sort of balanced approach, it had to be one that was ingrained in really eating good and delicious food. And so Fresh was really about stepping back and looking at the sorts of recipes that I could almost kind of get away with and make, you know, and make healthy. So I mean, from that point of view, that's why and that's where it came about from. And you know, I look at it now, and it's I think it's about 3 years old in Ireland, because it actually came out in Ireland two years ago. But, you know, I've been living with these recipes for the last 3 or 4 years, and these sorts of recipes are the ones that I do come back to. They are the ones that are part of my weekly plan, you know, when I'm coming up with what I'm going to eat for the week. And, you know, even that approach just to planning ahead, you know, there was some serious, like, life changes I made when I was writing that book. And even down to yoga and meditation, I know, and as an Irish person, you instantly cringe when you hear those words, but those aspects of kind of retaking your life and kind of reevaluating, you know, the sorts of things that are important. And for me, they were, you know, taking time out to appreciate the things that I actually love to do.
Yeah, so, taking time out is one thing that you mentioned in it, because you spoke about just simply sitting down, you know, be it if you play some nice music or light a candle and sitting down and enjoying your food, because that is something that is actually crucial, but very difficult, surprisingly difficult, because when you're so wired and you're so tuned in and turned on with all the stuff that's around you, with just loud music and your phone and your laptop and putting something on the TV while you sit down to have a meal, I struggle to do it at times, just to sit down and not do anything but look at the plate in front of me. And you actually give appreciation for the food that you're consuming and what you're eating, instead of just kind of shoveling it into your mouth and saying, okay, I'm full, and now let's see what's going to happen next. That in itself, I think, is a great lesson, and something that you touched on in the book.
Yeah, I mean, and I think I would not have had that appreciation, you know, had I not had that moment of going, this is just out of control, you know. And I think everyone suffers from that aspect of just being swept up by life and not being able to see the wood for the trees, and not taking that time to step out and kind of look at where you're at and how you want to, you know, approach your food, how you want to approach your exercise, how you want to approach, you know, your mental well-being in some respects, you know. And I think, you know, this is stuff that certainly from an Irish perspective, you know, we have a sort of, you know, only in recent times are we kind of speaking about these sorts of things, you know. Only in recent times is this something that's no longer like taboo, or no longer getting slagged off for talking about, you know.
Yeah.
And I think it's such a great thing, because, you know, you're right, like you think of like a dinner time, and, you know, how many of us sits down for dinner and puts your phone away and doesn't have a TV on, or there's no radio in the background? It, you know, I think you could probably say there's very few of us who really do hone in on just eating the food and communicating. And I think, you know, it's harder. It's easier to say than it is to do, but I think if you can make, you know, absolute effort towards it, you know, it does have a genuine impact on how you are and how you approach the world, you know.
Absolutely, absolutely. And just to go back to life on the West Coast, you know, being healthy and living that lifestyle must be a lot easier in a place like that. No doubt you're surrounded by places like In-N-Out, where you have burgers that you want to get back to. But can you just tell us a little bit more about Gone American, the show, the pilot that just aired 4 days ago?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, actually, I should point out that there's an In-N-Out burger like 10, like even 5 minutes walkable from our house. So yes, temptation is always around the corner. And sometimes you have to give in to it. So, you know, it's all about the balance. But yeah, Gone American was a pilot that we shot for Cooking Channel. It's just aired, but it was a really great little show to record. I did it with my wife, Sophie, and she was in the car with me. It was a good old American road trip, and we went from South Dakota to Wyoming. The whole aim of the show is, you know, we've just moved here, and, you know, it's all about kind of understanding culture beyond those big cities of New York and LA. Because, I mean, to be perfectly honest, that is my experience of America. I really haven't traveled within the kind of, I've been to New Orleans, I've been to Philadelphia, but, you know, I really haven't seen that true Americana that, you know, you see in the movies. And, you know, this was an aim of, our aim was really to kind of experience what real America was about. And let me just tell you, South Dakota and Wyoming definitely delivers on that front.
Yeah. What did you guys experience while you were there?
Well, we had like the authentic American diner, which serves up Coca-Cola pancakes. We went to a cowboy dude ranch, and we were cooking out with the cowboys, and we went to this incredible, which is total Americana, this place called Wall Drug, which is this basically this kind of roadside stop, gift shop / everything you could possibly imagine in one place. There's like, you know, Davy Crockett hats, there's donuts, there's everything you could possibly imagine of tat. You will find it at Wall Drug, but it's brilliant in that sense. And it's, you know, we just experienced that real American culture, and, you know, what you don't always see on the TV or in movies, and that was quite exciting. We spent some time in the Badlands, which is this fantastic national park with really unique landscapes. And we learned a little bit about American Indian culture. And, you know, I just saw a side of America that I had never seen before. And actually, funnily enough, having spoken to a few Americans, which quite a lot of Americans actually don't see, you know, if you don't travel outside the big cities.
So absolutely.
It was definitely, a very unique experience.
And could this be Sophie's breakthrough to be on the other side of the camera?
Well, I think she's getting very used to it. She's always been kind of, she's always had little elements of it, but she's never been in a full episode. So, yes, I definitely think she got a taste for it. She's used to carrying around things behind me, so I think she was very happy to be on, be the star for the day.
Well, that's great. And what do you guys have any other stuff lined up in the future now that you're based on the West Coast?
Well, our big focus is YouTube out here. You know, the control you have of creating your own content and, you know, I suppose in the long run, being able to push that out is what our big focus is out here. And we've just started a production company ourselves as well with two guys back home. And we're shooting an Irish series for RTE, which is our first ever self-produced series. So really, in my mind, that is kind of the future of where we're going with, you know, content, is creating really great quality food content that can be shared as far and as wide as possible. And at the core of it, really finding projects that we're passionate about, projects that, you know, you can showcase exciting and interesting stories in food. And I think from my point of view, that's where I get the most satisfaction, you know, that creative side of it. But that, I suppose, as well, and keeping up what I'm already doing. But yeah, I mean, as always, you know, I'm always looking for new opportunities, and I'm always looking to the new exciting project to get behind.
And just to touch on that, how does the, because I kind of understand that the blogging as such, you know, be it in food or in fashion or lifestyle, how that kind of works as a business. But how does producing content on YouTube for food with recipes, like your channel and say Jamie Oliver's Food Tube and various other people, how does that work? How does that work as a business?
So it's really funny. We shot this documentary about the world of YouTube, and my question that I put to every single creator was, how do you make money from YouTube? And not one single person could answer me a straight answer. But I would sum it up as, you make your money on YouTube from advertising, from the actual videos on YouTube itself. And then you do, and then there's a lot of people who work with brands and to sponsor their content. So that is primarily where the YouTube model is. But in saying that, you know, lots of people do it in different ways, and, you know, you'll have creators who've now moved on from YouTube who create content for networks and, you know, who approach it completely differently. So it's really a case by case situation, but it's an exciting, you know, it's an exciting world to be a part of, because, you know, I think having made so many TV shows, I think I've made nearly 16 television shows for different networks every time. You have an appreciation for the control and the creative aspect of what you can create that you just never have with a network, because there's obviously other people making decisions, which, you know, which is a great thing in some ways, but then at the same time, you don't get that freedom to kind of go at it the way you possibly might want to.
Absolutely. And if people want to find you on YouTube, it's just Donald Skeham. Is that the YouTube channel?
It is. It's the one name that you'll find very hard to say and to spell, but that is my name.
I'm going to spell it out. It's Donalskehan, and it's the same on Instagram as well, if people want to follow you on there, because there's a lot of great, beautiful pictures of the food that you produce and some short little video clips of your recipes as well.
Yes, indeed. Thank you very much.
Well, it's been a pleasure having you on here, Donal. Unfortunately, we did record an episode on St. Patrick's Day, which I was delighted to do, but it didn't materialize. The equipment let us down, but I'm really, really glad that you've come back on and joined me this time around.
Patrick, what's that saying about a workman and his tools? What does that go like again?
I get what you're trying to say anyway.
No, I know, it's my pleasure. I'm sorry for giving you a hard time. Honestly, you're doing great things on the show, and I'm really excited to hear more of what's going on.
Cheers, Donald. Thanks very much. I also want to extend my thanks to Heritage Radio for giving Why Food and 33 other shows a platform for conversation and community outside of the mainstream of food. I also want to give a great thank you to David Tadashore for producing today's show. If you enjoyed today's episode, please rate and subscribe to the show. That small action has a huge reaction for the show's popularity. And I want to say thank you so much to you for listening to today's show. If you ever want to get in touch, please email me at whyfood@heritageradionetwork.org, or you can connect with me on Instagram at whyfoodpodcast. Thanks so much, guys. Have a wonderful week. Until we meet again.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.